Committee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Tuesday, April 12, 2005, and we're going to do some pretty fancy maneuvering here today. What I will do first is open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5518, which is the budget bill for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And as a courtesy to Commissioner John Griffith, I will call him forward at this time to testify on the Land Conservation and Development Bill. Commissioner Griffith has a early appointment back in his district, so we will take him first to allow him to get back on the freeway. Commissioner, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. I didn't hear about this opportunity to testify until late yesterday, but stayed over an extra day because I was in the town yesterday. And
for the record, could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. John Griffith, Coos County Commissioner, Coos Bay, Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay, as far as the Department of Land Conservation and Development goes, I'm going to make my remarks out of experience as first just an ordinary citizen, and then in 2001 I became a county commissioner. I just got reelected. We have to go back a bit in time to 1972. That was when Congress adopted the Coastal Zone Management Act. 1 year later, Oregon Senate Bill 100, which is in the ORS 197s, picked up the Oregon's land use plan and system as it's pretty much known today. Coastal Zone Management Act, since federal government can't compel like planning of a state, they typically do in things like this is set a bunch of money off to the side and say if you want it, you have to adopt the relevant parts of this law. So the relevant parts of the Coastal Zone Management Act are a state agency. They set land use criteria at the state, and it is enforced on local governments. A couple of definitions that might be helpful in the Coastal Zone Management Act. The term enforceable policy means state policies which are legally binding through constitutional provisions, laws, regulations, land use plans, ordinances, or judicial or administrative decisions by which a state exerts control over private and public land and water uses and natural resources in the coastal zone. That's from Section 304 of the Coastal Zone Management Act. Measure 37 has come along, which has thrown a bit of a curve in a lot of things. One of them, I believe, is that the enforcement requirement that Oregon must have in order to continue to receive the $2.376 million a year it gets by being a Coastal Zone Management Act state could be at jeopardy. When a state amends its acknowledged coastal zone management program, if the Secretary of Commerce doesn't agree and acknowledge that amendment, the Act says that the state can't get any more money. All right. There's another point. This is more just on background. What the coastal zone is supposed to be, again, it Section 304 of the Coastal Zone Management Act, it says the zone extends inland from the shoreline only to the extent necessary to control shorelands, the uses of which might have a direct and significant impact on the coastal waters, and to control those geographical areas which are likely to be affected by or vulnerable to sea level rise. Oregon set its Coastal Zone Management Act, its coastal zone, to the summit of the Coast Range, which even if the whole polar ice cap melt, probably won't be sucked up in sea level rise. In any event, I think part of the reason they did that is because the formula for money is based on a minimum rate plus your population in your designated coastal zone and then square miles. So it helps them get more money by making it as big as they did. They probably have some other rationale for its size, but that's just my opinion. Again, they get $2.376 million through the Coastal Zone Management Act per year, and that's according to this, which I didn't bring extra copies of. That's their grant application to NOAA for Coastal Zone Management Act for the period of 1 July 04 through 30 June 05. It lays out a lot of what they plan to do. I asked for the latest one because this one was made in April 04. I went to Department of Land Conservation a month or so ago, and they didn't have it yet. They also have five-year reports where they lay out what they plan to do to receive the money, and they didn't have that one yet. The last one that they had is for 01 through 05. And
excuse me, Commissioner. Representative Krieger has a question.
John, that grant application, who wrote that? Do you know who wrote the grant application?
Yeah, Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger. To my knowledge, it was written by Bob Bailey.
Who's Bob Bailey?
Again, he's in charge, I believe he's in charge of the Coastal Management Program at Department of Land Conservation.
Is this the same gentleman that went to the coast a couple of years ago and held meetings up and down the coast? I believe there was 250 in Brookings, 70 or so in Port Orford. And as you came up the coast, we ended up, give or take, 1,000 people. Two in Curry County reporting were in favor of marine reserves, two out of the Cannon Beach area, and then all the favorable testimony beyond that was, in fact, from Audubon Society in Portland. Is that the same person that did that, those hearings?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, yes.
And on the Internet, if you wanted to go look it up, it's still available. 250 people in Brookings, not one in favor, but two in Curry County, none in Coos County. By the time you get done, you got nearly 1,000 people. And on the Internet, it says that there is great support statewide for the creation of marine reserves. And I took a great offense to that, and since that time, that man's not been allowed in a hearing room I'm in or in my office from that agency, and they were told not to bring him in. Was there another statement, Mr. Griffith, that he made at a meeting you're aware of, had to do with the governor's office?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, that, in fact, I wrote to the land board. That would have been in February of 2003, and I wasn't there, but my colleague Nikki Witte was there, so I got the tape and listen to it. And the question from Governor Kulongoski to Bob Bailey was, is there a bill in on this Ocean Policy Advisory Council, its configuration and things like that? And he said that there was not.
At the time, I was meeting with Nan Evans, and he wasn't allowed in my office, and she was the one that was negotiating with me about the contents of that bill. So in reality, he had to know, because she'd been negotiating with me for over a month.
Mm-hmm. Chair Morgan,
sure,
Representative.
Sure.
Krieger, in my letter to the land board, I included emails from him with dates that preceded his remarks to the land board when he said that there wasn't a bill there that showed he was working on the LC.
Please proceed, Commissioner.
Okay. As Representative Krieger pointed out, there was considerable testimony at meetings at Brookings, Port Orford, North Bend, Newport, and Astoria of concern in 2002 about Ocean Policy Advisory Council, or OPAC, was marching out a plan to begin designating no fishing marine reserves on the coast. And the coastal governments and all but a few of our citizens who showed up at the meetings were very vehemently opposed to them. Nevertheless, in their planning documents. They continue to say that they're working towards developing this plan. This is in the 2001 to 2005 grant application. It says new regulations and management approaches are needed to sustain nearshore fisheries and protect habitat. Public interest groups and even the Pacific Fishery Management Council are calling for no-take fishery areas, marine reserves, as a means of addressing problems of overfishing or significant declines of some species of rockfish on the West Coast, and as a management tool that responds to ecosystem needs. If those of you who are familiar with the forest management, everything's sort of looked at now as on the ecosystem, which is sort of a loosely applied term, can mean any number of things. So the old sciences, physical sciences, aren't quite hold the sway that they used to anymore. Now the ecologists seem to be running the show. Nobody wants to make mistakes with management, of course, but this, say, it gives a foundation to the idea that until you understand everything, you've got to be beyond the precautionary principle that they apply to things now. You've got to apply some sort of exponential precautionary principle to the precautionary principle. At those meetings that I talked about that they had on the coast, the fishermen and others were saying, you know, give us fishing restrictions. We know how they work. They're far more flexible. You can put them on, take them off, respond to situations. They pointed out that Oregon has authority only out to 3 miles, that a lot of these assertions that were being made fail to recognize that fish move. Some of the habitat, like plants or something growing on rocks, certainly want to take care of that, but they also fail to recognize that bottom contact trawls are pretty much not even allowed inshore anymore. That's their way out there. So really, the people from the coast are asking, let's have a real discussion about what sort of shortcomings we have in management and work on them, and let's agree on what's scientific and what's maybe hypothesis, probably not any more formal than that at this point, and see if we can't come to some sort of terms as to what the coast could support. But that didn't really grow any legs. Instead, in August of 2002, the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, I believe, again at the manipulation, I guess, of Department of Land Conservation, just marched out a final plan and sent it on over to Governor Kitzhaber. Again, they keep using these absolute terms in their grant applications. In other words, they're sort of setting out deliverables they're going to give to NOAA to continue to receive the money. It says it is the need to address larger spatial, temporal, and ecological dimensions of nearshore and shelf systems that makes the emergence of the marine protected areas issue so important for Oregon's ocean program and for future Section 309 supported work. So they're just laying out their track. I believe in part is why they failed to pay anything more than just take the testimony of the coast, was because they've already spent a lot of NOAA money on these sorts of projects, and they want to get them delivered. Just to make sure, they also had these meetings in Portland and Corvallis. I didn't watch those on videotape, nor did I drive up to them, but I presume they probably got some more favorable comments there because that's what they went with, was against whatever they heard on the coast for the position that evidently they heard someplace else. So I guess to close up on it, of that money that they're getting for this program, just their coastal program, that's $2.376 million. That's a year from NOAA, and the state matches $2.16 million a year. Some of it's from OWEB, so it doesn't all show up in the text of the bill that's before you today. And with that, if you have any questions, I'd welcome them.
Questions or comments? Representative Krieger.
Last session, you, myself, Jim Myron, and Mike Carrier basically wrote 3534. Which was, it's the OPAC bill, known as Marine Reserve Bill. And the governor signed that bill. Can you describe the changes, John, and the reason for the change in the makeup of OPAC? In other words, what it was before and how it was being able to be manipulated by Governor Kitzhaber to where it would be now?
And Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, the OPAC is found at 196.400s. Previously, it was, I think, eight or nine state agencies and the governor's natural resources person. The governor's person was always the chair. All the agencies had a vote. And then you had a commercial fishermen, one from the north, one from the south, sport fishermen, north-south, tribes, recreationists, some environmental seats. But there was 23 of them, and I figured if all those people who were real ocean users all hung together, which they never did, it would have been 8 to 15. So the outcome was always assured of whatever the governor, Department of Land Conservation Development, wanted. It was just a simple setup. So your bill, House Bill 3534, it made those agencies non-voting. It reconfigured it a little. Before, there was one county commissioner only, and now there's one from the three northern counties and one from the four southern counties. The commercial, sport fishing, recreation, environmental seats, those take Senate confirmation. I had a bit of a hand, as you know, in the bill, so I have quite a strong feeling about local government, locally elected officials, so the county commission seats do not take Senate confirmation.
The premise of what we were trying to create, I guess this is kind of a statement, what there would be meaningful input from the affected coastal communities and the people who had something to gain or lose because of the ocean management. And I think that 3534 really got there, and we're just now going to confirm those people. And I have no trouble in my own mind about who's going to be on there, whether they be from the environmental side or county commissioner, or if they're someone that's there's a position on there from the city and the tribes, and we never argued that point. John is the only one, of course. Everybody knows the big battle getting John on OPAC. I want to state again, because this is so important to the coastal communities, I believe that where Audubon was trying to go, it would have affected the coastal communities exactly like the owl did if we let them continue where they were going down. I do not object to having marine reserves. In fact, I committed to Mr. Kafori last session and other people that I would not hinder that, but I wanted a process in place. And part of that process is a process that Oregon Coastal Zone Management put in place of six criteria that you had to meet before you created marine reserves. And it's kind of strange that the only guy in the room today who's created Marine Reserve is the guy they won't let on OPAC, and that's John Griffith. Because he's not opposed to Marine Reserves. My commercial fishermen are opposed to Marine Reserves. But we have to be careful where we put them, that we don't destroy the economy, that we understand how we're going to fund them, the purpose that they're going to serve for our coastal communities, and they might very well provide a benefit to the coastal communities. A little later on, Madam Chair, when we actually get into the agency later on, I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that John has covered, because I think it goes a little bit more than I want to do right now. But John, do you have any thoughts regarding the state continuing to contribute the match money to the federal government?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, the state, according to newspapers, is legislature, you folks are trying mightily to balance your budget. And I just say, I don't have the total number, but of the couple million that DLC gets a year for its coastal program, just as an example, it kicks down only $36,000 to Coos County, and we're one of seven coastal counties. It gives some to cities, too. But I've seen, shall I call it, quite a bit of mischief from the coastal program of Department of Land Conservation, which is one big program if you look at their budget. And so I would suggest you could use a pretty sharp pencil and find some way to maybe make them a bit more responsive to the people they're supposed to serve.
Is there any type of report that LCDC has to do semi-annually regarding the ocean program? Are you aware of any report they're required to submit?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, they have to make semi-annual reports, and that brings up an interesting point. The Measure 37, as I mentioned, it throws that into a bit of a question as to whether or not they're still going to have an approved or acknowledged coastal management program. And I've communicated some with NOAA because I'm a little bit worried about that $36,000. Of course, that's one position in the Coos County Planning Department. And the response from NOAA is that they'll make their analysis of Oregon's program's conformance with the Coastal Zone Management Act when they get their next semi-annual report. And I don't know when that's due.
Chair.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Griffin, I want to go back to something you alluded to in your earlier testimony. Is it your opinion that Mr. Bailey from the department perjured himself in public hearing?
Chair Morgan, Representative Kraft, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't think I could give you an opinion on that, but I could give you a copy of the letter if you like.
Madam Chair, for the record, there are two ORSs that govern the testimony of elected officials when testifying in front of public hearings, and those ORSs say that that testimony must be truthful. So if, in fact, it could be established that Mr. Bailey knowingly falsified his testimony, to the best of your knowledge, was that complained about? Was there anything ever done about it?
Chair Morgan, Representative Kraft, apart from the letter I wrote, I don't know if there was anything else done about it. But, you know, Bob's, he's an appointed guy. He's not an elected official.
But he, Madam Chair, he is an employee of the state. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. The ORS also covers elected officials and employees of the state. All right, Madam Chair, I just state that I find it very disturbing that an employee of the department would knowingly falsify his testimony in public hearing and nothing was done about it. I would hope that we would have a higher standard in this state for both elected officials and for employees to be honorable in their comments before our body or any others. With that, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Shaffer.
Briefly, thank you. It seems to be there's some issues with the language in the grants and the where the money's spent when we get it and the makeup of the committee. Is there any way that we could rewrite the grants, spend the money somewhere else? The committee appointment, well, we all know what happens there. But that would more or better reflect the wants and needs of the people on the coast that are actually where this money is, I'd assume, supposed to be going. Is there a solution to this problem? That's what I'm asking you, I guess.
Yeah, Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler. The I think that depends on you folks to do what you think would be appropriate to make the system work better. I mean, we all know what happened to Oregon's land use system on November 2nd.
Representative Creeper.
Chair Morgan, just so we have it on the record before John leaves, I want to have a copy of the last three semi-annual reports that the department has submitted to NOAA. And I would hope that this committee would require the department to bring this present grant application
to us so we understand what we're agreeing to, because it never showed up here the last two sessions that I've been here. I believe it's gone through the emergency board system to get their grant. As far as I know, I don't remember them coming here asking for the grant. So we need to have a much closer look at this, and then I need to spend some time with Director Shetterly.
Well, and when the director comes forward to finish the agency's budget detail, we can raise these issues at that time. Further questions or comments? Thank you very much, Commissioner Griffith. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule, and I wish you a swift and safe trip back to the coast.
Thanks.
And with that, I'm going to recess the hearing on Senate Bill 5518. And I am going to, we have a hearing that we carried over from yesterday, so I'm going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 5073, which is the Water Resources Department budget. And we are in public testimony, and I will call forward Anita Winkler from the Oregon Water Resources Congress. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Morgan and members of the committee, first let me thank the chair for her willingness. For the record, Anita Winkler, Oregon Water Resources Congress.
Thank you.
I'm here on behalf of our organization, but I'm also here on behalf of a full task force, and we ask that this be carried over today because all of us on the task force, five of us were up in the Water Resources or the Water Committee yesterday, and the sixth one was in D.C. So thank you for accommodating our kind of complicated schedules. In the interest of keeping this short and because of the commitment I made to keep this short, I'm going to testify on behalf of the entire task force. There's several other members here today if you have questions, and I get in trouble, so they'll bail me out. And I think I'd like to start by recognizing this task force. This is a group of stakeholders in the department who became very concerned as we heard about the governor's proposed budget and the impact on the department. And we convened ourselves. The department did not bring us together. We just got together because we were that worried. And I think what's particularly remarkable is this is a coalition of muni interests, agricultural interests, and environmental interests who sat down in the room together and worked on a tough topic of water. And secondarily, we came to a unanimous agreement in about 45 minutes about our concerns over the proposed budget. So probably set a record for something dealing with water in this state to do it that fast and that comprehensively. As a general comment, we're just deeply concerned about cuts to a department that is going to find extraordinary pressure on its staff and its function this year as a result of the drought. We can hypothesize how far and how deep that drought's going to cut. And we had six more counties declared drought counties yesterday. We're up to eight. My membership is just struggling. We have districts that will not deliver any water this year and others who will deliver half water. Some will be on 28-day rotations. It's pretty deep in outside the Willamette Valley. The department has a whole series of tools, as we call them, to enable water users to better survive. I'm not sure that's a good word, survive the drought, but to enable them to get through the drought. But those all require intense amounts of staff work. You can't just send the application in, the staff's going to generate it and turn it right back out. They still have to go through injury assessment of other water rights. They still have to figure out if there's water available. It's complex. It's labor-intensive beyond anything that I could have ever expected when I got into this business. So here's a department that's just going to get hit hard this year, trying to respond to a natural disaster, as some call it, and facing proposed budget cuts of some key staff. I have attached a three pages, detail of the proposed reductions in the governor's budget, and we organized them by division, which matches up with the LFO's analysis of the governor's budget. I was hoping this would make it easier for you to match up with what we were trying to talk from, because I was working from a totally different sheet to begin with. And I think rather than go through each one in detail, you all can read it later, but I would just summarize. This was the sheet that we had that the Water Resources Department gave us to work from. And the interesting part was, is when we got done, the line was right halfway through the numbers. We drew a line right in here. These were, we'd like to keep them, but we realize that we can't have everything. These are really critical to us. And then when I went through and added up the numbers, it was just shy of a 50-50 split of things that we could let go and things that we felt we held near and dear to our heart and to the function of the department. But it's, and the ones we held near and dear were positions. They're people to do the work. They're people that collect the data, people that manage the data and get it on the website, the programmers that get that information up for the water management team at the department, the managers of my member districts who manage water for all of their water users, and the water masters out on the field can figure out what's going on, who has water, where there's water, who should be regulated off. It's just critical data to have current and have accurate. We also, there's some positions in here that we call certificate issuance and water rights support, who are the people who either directly process the paperwork or they do some of the work to allow the professional staff to process the paperwork. And I understand a lot of times the support staff are kind of the easy ones to let go of when none of them are easy. But in this case, we lose the support staff, we'll lose the professional staff because they'll be doing some of that support work. And that includes the customer service counter. My members don't use the customer service counter. We generally deal with water resources via email or fax or, you know, over the phone. But individual water users, individual farmers and other smaller water users walk into the department and rely on that staff to try and get their way through a very complicated process. That's such that if you mess up the first time you submit the paperwork, you're delayed incalculable amount of time because they have to find it, you have to come back through. It just makes it really difficult for those small water users to be able to access the services of the department. I wish I could tell you that we were comfortable or that we'd set priorities among the group of reductions that we're opposing. We didn't. We literally could not. Each one of those was important to at least one of us, and none of us could agree that any of them were acceptable to lose. We just had a collective agreement that this is decimating the department. I think, and I wasn't here for the department's testimony, but they've previously described it as thinning the spokes on the wheel. And I told them, I think the wheel's thinned enough, it's going to collapse now. And that's, I'm not trying to cry wolf, I'm not trying to whine, but that's really our belief, is the department has gotten to the point that they're barely able to manage their current workload. They finally are not getting further behind, they're kind of staying on top of what's coming in and starting to catch up with some of the backlog, and faced with a really untenable couple of years now with the drought that we'll just see things. I'm just afraid we won't be able to respond to the needs of the community.
Well, that kind of blows my question, because I was going to ask you if you could triage these and tell us which ones you're that you felt were the most critical to maintain in terms of the operations of the department.
I think we got a two-part triage, and that you'll see some that we oppose, and we oppose the reduction, and those that we don't oppose the reduction. And once we got to the oppose the reduction, we simply couldn't get any further because they were just too important. We couldn't find a way to say let a programmer go when that person's responsible for this very technical programming that gets the data up on the website. Or the data person who collects that data, makes sure it's good, works with the smaller permit users to get the data in. So you kind of have, you know, where's the stair step on this? Or the person at the counter who means that those other guys aren't up at the counter doing the work. And it just, it's kind of, they're just so intertwined in the way that they do the work that we couldn't see one go without kind of watching the rest of it just begin to collapse.
Questions or comments from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Dingfeld.
Thank you. Thank you, Anita. I have a question regarding, and these are really helpful comments, so I appreciate it. You guys are all the end users and work very closely with the Water Resources Department. Did you look at fee adjustments at all, in other words, to offset some of these cuts? Because 2 years ago, we went through a whole fee adjustment, especially looking in the groundwater users came forward and said, yes, we agree, and this needs to be done. Was there any discussion about that?
The only discussion was that we agreed to pretty significant fee increases last year, especially for transfers, and there was a second layer of cuts proposed that cut into those general fund positions because we'd stepped up with the fees last year. And we didn't see that extra round of reduction still on the table. We didn't comment on those. But it was in the context of we stepped up last year to fund certain activities to get the backlog reduced, which has been working. But then the rest of these, we didn't talk about fees. And I'm not sure how some of these that are really broad-based management kinds of functions we could actually do with fees.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Thank you very much, Ms. McClure.
Thank you.
I appreciate you taking your time out. Committee members, I'd also draw your attention to a memo from the director, Phil Ward, just with some follow-up information from the budget presentation from yesterday. And is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 5073, the Water Resources Budget? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5073. And I will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 5518, which is the Department of Land Conservation and Development budget, and ask the director to come forward and complete the presentation on the budget detail. Thank you for appearing before us today, Director Shetterly, and we have seen your must be working your copy machines quite a bit over there at the department. Could you talk to us about what we have in these displays?
I do have my thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Two things, perhaps, that we can cover.
For the record.
I'm sorry, for the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Gosh, this seat is hot. The two things that I would offer to cover with you this afternoon, and we have, I think, some public testimony lined up as well, so I'll try to be brief, but I want to give the committee the information you need. First of all, what you have in these bound packets that are just being distributed to you is a memorandum from me dated last Friday. These were delivered on Friday to LFO in response to the committee's questions of last week, specifically regarding the coastal program. It includes copies of the five-year strategies for the assessment of management capabilities 2001 to 2005 that Commissioner Griffith referred to in his testimony. It also includes, as requested, the 2004-2005 Coastal Management Program grant application. That is the current grant application, and it does include the draft of the grant application for the coming year, 2005 to 2006. Those were requested, and we did burn some toner at the copy machine to get these to you, but they are there, and again, they were delivered on Friday of last week.
Mr. Shetter, can you describe for the committee the process that the Coastal Zone Management Program grant takes through this Byzantine operation that we have here?
Oh, Madam Chair, that's addressed in I'm looking for it here. That is addressed, I think, on page 3 of the memorandum, because you did ask about that. It's Byzantine. It's also a part of our compliance with the federal requirements through NOAA. Individual grant tasks are developed by the Coastal Program annually. Those are submitted to NOAA based on the most recent, the current five-year enhancement strategy, indicating progress of work to date and then work proposed for the coming year. They're submitted by April 15 of each year and then relate to grant funds becoming available on July 1. So they are prepared within the department based on the five-year enhancement strategy that right now goes back to the 2001-2005 strategy that, again, you have with you. Those are submitted and on approval by NOAA. That satisfies the grant requirements for the release of the federal funds to the program.
So as a follow-up, the grant is submitted directly to NOAA. There's no process where it comes through the legislature like a lot of the other grant applications that we see?
Madam Chair, maybe Sue can double-check me on this, and Christina, too, since this is my first session. These grants are all within the expenditure authority that's approved as part of the DLCD budget. So that expenditure authority is already covered for the biennium on the grants submitted. And I want to check my answer to that with our BAM analyst. And Sue? Okay. So these, yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christina Shear, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. The Coastal Zone Management Program is a grant program, but it falls under the exemption of a formula grant. In other words, if they meet the criteria of the program, the agency will provide the funding. It is not a competitive grant program, as is somewhat more common. You're more frequently used to seeing. So the grants that you see in front of the emergency board and in front of this committee are competitive grants that are not assured year to year, and each agency must reapply and or compete with other agencies to receive the funding. That is not the case with this program.
Follow-up. Representative Schachter.
Director, and maybe you too. So I don't want to get anything going here that isn't in appropriate sequence, but you heard what was said here this afternoon, and you weren't in your position during, I believe, the time all this stuff happened. Are we throughout this process going to hear your? Are we going to ask him to respond to that, and or do you, are you? Is he going to respond to it today? Are y'all going to come back? Are you working on this? There's a lot going on here.
Yeah, right? Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I guess what I would. You're right, and thank you for pointing out that the discussion that occurred with Commissioner Griffith, from what I heard, did relate to a period of time 2001 to 2003 and up into the last session. I guess what I would be prepared to be responsible for is what we are proposing and what we're asking relative to this budget and our program going forward. As you know, irrespective of what may or may not have happened in the past, one of the directives that the governor gave me coming in as director was to make a change and to move the program forward effectively and to make it a partner with the communities that we serve. And I hope you're going to hear some other testimony this afternoon that confirms that we are moving in that direction. So my request would be to focus on the direction that we are going the very positive things that are happening in the program in that respect, specifically with regard to marine reserves, which was obviously a flashpoint in the conversation with Mr. Griffith. He referred to language in one of the documents that you have. It was the 2001 to 2005 five-year plan. That language goes back to, I think, 2001 or 2002, at which point OPAC, the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, not the department, but OPAC, had indicated a direction to move towards establishing marine reserves. And so that went in at that point in time to this five-year plan, anticipating that OPAC was going to follow through. Since then, after last session, and actually before, OPAC has become non-functioning until it becomes reappointed and becomes active again. And so all of that work on the marine reserves has fallen off of the program. And if you look at the current grant agreement and if you look at the draft, we are not engaged in marine reserves. And so again, even that discussion really is about what happened in the past. We will take direction from OPAC so that if OPAC in its reconstituted form indicates a direction that they want to go, one of the functions of the department is to staff the council. But that's what we do. We staff the council. We don't create the policy.
You know, I think this should be said by somebody from the urban area. We don't have a coastal member on Metro and a wide, large number of advisory committees in the urban area in Portland. We don't have a coastal member. This would be absurd to do it. I think, as Representative Krieger pointed out, we generously allow for at-large members in specific areas of the community on these advisory committees, whether they're on the coast or not. If this money's meant to manage the coast, that's where it should be going. And if it ain't, then we need to rewrite the language, do something. I don't know what, but I just want to say that, because I live in an urban area, and we're getting representation on a coastal advisory committee, and that's pretty generous. But if the tables were turned around the other way, if someone suggested we have a coastal member on some metropolitan advisory committee, it would be kind of funny. But I just wanted to make that comment.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffer, just for clarification, the coastal program dollars are directed at the coast, again, as defined for the Federal and State Act purposes as being west of the summit of the Cascades. So you may not,
okay.
It may not be beachfront, but it is coastal in its aspect. So there are no coastal dollars being spent okay. in the metro area or anywhere else. I think you asked the question, Madam Chair, about our VCOG for some hazards planning. And this, again, is just a function of the federal mapping. For some hazards, I think stormwater and pollution control, it's addressed in the memorandum. They do draw, for that limited purpose, up the Rogue Valley and just go that far in. And so they are eligible under that particular piece of the federal program for some money in RVCOG that they've used. But, again, for federal purposes, that constitutes coastal.
Further questions or comments on the marine reserve issue? A comment? You want to do it now? Okay. Let's proceed then.
Okay. Madam Chair, I will leave this with you. Again, I understand, appreciate that you are inundated with paper, and I'll leave it to you, and I'll be happy to visit with you individually about any questions you might have about this. But again, to underscore, this is responsive to every one of the questions that was directed at the department last Tuesday, and it does include a summary of positions, including specific position descriptions of the coastal program staff, as well as the current and draft coastal zone management application and the current five-year plan. I should point out, as the memo does, that with respect to the five-year plan, there is another one in draft that will be due later this year, that not in draft, but that is due later this year. So there will be one coming up for 06 and into the future. But this is the only thing that we have a hard copy of at this point. Okay, with that, Madam Chair, and keeping in mind that I want to save time for folks who have come in to testify, I would, if with the committee's permission, would move to Measure 37, which has some specific issues that are key to our program that are not reflected in the budget. As we've discussed before, the governor's budget was prepared well in advance. That is, the budget preparation occurred well in advance of the passage of ballot measure 37. So it wasn't even law when the budget was prepared. but it is nevertheless having significant impacts on budget as well as staff and resources, and is going to have to be accommodated for the coming biennium. I've brought George Naughton with me. George is our most excellent deputy director on loan from Budget and Management, who's been an invaluable assistant in managing this unsought and unplanned for addition to our workload. I'll just make a few brief comments and then let him discuss the package that is proposed to address the ballot measure 37 impacts. One of the questions the committee had last week, and I think a couple times even before, was, well, with ballot measure 37, if you have to devote your staff to that, what work doesn't get done? And I just want to underscore a couple things about that. We've talked in the last times that I've been before you about taking seriously our charge to be out in communities working proactively as the sort of the community policing model, helping communities with their local planning objectives for land use and economic development. Key to that is having staff that is able to spend time at City Hall and in the planning department and the county courthouse working with local staff. We have a complex land use program. There's no question about that. One of the things that we can do as a department, and I think have done in the past year, is use our expertise to help solve problems at the local level. And trying to move away from the more regulatory mode. If we are in a position of having to devote staff to ballot measure 37, it is going to significantly affect our ability to be proactive and spend that kind of time in communities. We've made some great progress in the last year. I'm very hopeful that we can continue that with our specialists and our field staff. And also their participation in the economic revitalization team. Those have been high priorities for us. And this budget package and some assistance in managing ballot measure 37 with additional staff is going to be critical in order to help us continue to serve that mission of the department and not lose that ground that we have gained in the past year as a partner with our local governments. With that, I'll ask George to carry you through the budget package, and then we'd be glad to answer questions.
Senator Krieger has a question.
Hey, you can't old age. I can't remember when it was now.
July. It was. It was the weekend of the four, just before the 4th of July.
Having a problem understanding a process, and you worked with the city planner.
Jody Farron.
Yeah. The thing that impressed me is you walked down, you analyzed the situation, and you saw that there should be a solution. That's what we're looking for, is these problem solving, you know, find a way to get to yes within the law.
Right.
And you've indicated that that's the type of thing. Have you got other instances where you've been able to be that successful that quick? You came out, you looked at it, you gave direction to your staff, they had it was solved.
Yep.
Yes, other instances where that happened?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, I do, and some even in the works. I'll give you a couple. I'm hoping that we'll hear from I haven't turned around to see if Mayor Popoff is here yet, but he was going to come up today to speak about what happened in Gold Beach, and also we're going to hear from Hermiston, West Umatilla County.
Hermiston, where's that?
Yeah, how about that? It's not in the coastal program.
Almost.
Two things out there, representatives, in this past year. One, that they were struggling with an urban growth boundary expansion to accommodate housing around a new golf course development. And they were having trouble, again, with the land use program, not the department, but just making things work with the rules and the statutes. Our field reps were able to spend time at City Hall and actually showed them the path to get to the urban growth boundary expansion, very well received. Also out in that area, they had some an effort with the county to designate some industrial and commercial lands. And with our staff, we actually helped them with our order in writing the appropriate findings to support the designation of more than 1,000 acres south of town as industrial and more than 300 acres north of town as commercial. Great outcome there. Senator Bates, recall in Medford, what looked like it could have been a set-to with the city over the transportation system plan. I think I might have mentioned this once to the committee already in an earlier visit. It was a matter of a phone call to the mayor, her talking to her staff, me talking to my staff, and that was the one that ended with the All's Well That Ends Well co-authored op-ed piece in the Medford Mail Tribune. We have others, and in fact we're working on a couple of others in other parts of the state. Well, quickly, Ontario, the siting of the Treasure Valley Renewable Resources Biofuels Facility, feedlot in Jefferson County, all these things that have been done with the hands-on assistance of the department. I'm very proud of that. It's a great record.
It seems going to be a different mindset if you're working with your same staff or employees. Are they starting to understand what their role is that's different? And do they like that new role? Or are they kind of resisting this change?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, are you asking, is it more fun to be welcomed into a city hall than to have stones thrown at you as you approach the front door? Yes, I think positive. The positive responses that we are getting from the communities that we serve have really been well received by department staff. And I think that when we talk about morale and energy over there, we have to keep in mind just a little gray cloud of ballot measure 37, this kind of hanging over things. But in terms of that core function of the program and what we do, I think there's great excitement and great buy-in. One more I'll mention is not because it's on the coast. It was the Tillamook Jetty, the North Jetty, that was just about to fail. They needed some fast work done on a federal consistency. And we had about a five-minute meeting around my office table, and the decision was that regardless of the short time frame that the feds gave us, we were going to do it. We were not going to be the department responsible for the Tillamook Jetty failing, and we got it done. And people feel good about that. And I would say that there really is a new sense of that energy and commitment department-wide over there.
Very briefly.
Senator Schaffer.
This million and a half dollar policy package, this is new, right?
Correct.
So all these great land use bills that are going through the House of Council make this whole thing moot. We don't have to spend this money. Is that correct, too, Mr. Director?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffer, I don't know if I would draft the budget on any assumption.
Let me say it then. You know, it'll make it moot, and we'll create jobs all at the same time, and we'll make the people of Oregon see that we're actually listening to what they're doing, listening to what they're saying. There we go. I'll say it for something.
Now, just in keeping with the kind of leapfrog nature of the process today, I'm going to ask our LFO staffer to give us a little bit of information. When we were talking about the grant, the Coastal Zone Management Grant, we got the perspective from DAS on what they look for in those grants, but I think it would be helpful if we get the perspective from what LFO looks for when they're evaluating grants.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, just a follow-up to what Christina said. In terms of the competitive versus the formula grant, that's not necessarily the only thing that LFO looks at, nor is it the key thing. What we look at is whether a grant would be for ongoing activities or for something new, and if it's ongoing activities for which the agency has already applied, then the assumption is that the legislature has already given approval and they can continue to apply year after year for those grants. If it's a new activity, then we like the agency to come forward so that the legislature has the opportunity to look at the grant program for things such as matching funds and staffing needs and things such as expectations that a program would continue even if federal funds went away. So I just want to make that clarification.
Are there any other circumstances where a continuing grant would be brought forward for a reevaluation or anything like that?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I suppose if a program at the federal level was going to be reauthorized and there were some significant changes in the program, we would like the agency to come forward if they were going to then apply for that program, which had been substantially changed. I can't imagine that there might be circumstances under which that would occur.
I wonder if Measure 37 would be one of those circumstances.
Good question, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, you have a memorandum for me, and I'm sorry, my file copy has the April 5th date on it. You got it a few days earlier than that. It addressed the coastal program in relation to your original budget prioritization of the program. And one of the things I attached, and so you should have in your files, was a letter from Richard Spinrad, Assistant Administrator at the National Ocean Service, addressed to Commissioner Griffith regarding the question that Commissioner Griffith had asked whether or not Measure 37 would make the state ineligible to continue to receive federal funding under the Coastal Management Zone Management Act. And the letter to from the feds, quoted in my memo, but also attached to it for the full text, it is far too early to draw any conclusions about the impact of Measure 37. They're certainly aware of it. Keep in mind, of course, that every state has a different program. That is, every coastal state has a different program. So it's not as if Measure 37 or the program pre-Measure 37 was a required program in every respect in order to qualify for federal funds. Every state is different. And I think that we have every expectation that we can accommodate Measure 37 within our overall planning program in such a way that will satisfy the feds. Again, it's not as if the funding from the feds was contingent on every aspect of the program being exactly as it was pre-Measure 37, because every state has a different program, and some are more regulatory, some far less.
Well, and that is a great segue to get back into the Measure 37 discussion.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm George Naughton, the acting deputy at the Department of Land Conservation and Development. What we've given to you today is really, we wanted to give you some comfort level as to the number that you saw, the $1.5 million. So what I'm going to do is just give you a little bit of background from a budget and actual work product level, what we're looking at. When, just for history, we came at the January, or the agency came at the January emergency board, which is January 6, 7. At that time, there were 60 claims in with the, just under 60 claims in with the state of Oregon, and the emergency board approved sufficient funding that we were able to bring on two temporary or limited duration planners for the end of this current biennium and one office specialist. Since that time, what you see on this sheet is that the number of claims has actually ballooned. We're now at what you see on your sheet there is, as of the end of March, 277 claims in with the state of Oregon. And I checked the numbers today with the Department of Administrative Services. And I'm, Madam Chair, working off of this sheet right here. Checked the numbers again today, and the Department of Administrative Services is up to 312 claims. So the number is growing quite rapidly. What we're looking at is that about 98% of the claims that get filed with the state come to the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Up to this point, 3 to 5 claims have been actually sent to other state agencies to be the lead regulating entity. So most of the ballot measure 37 claims are related to the state's land use laws in one way or another. Of the 98 claims that have come in to us, we then break them into various levels. We basically triage them when they come in. We break them. Claims become more complex to us for two main reasons. One is that from a planning perspective, the land was acquired prior to 1973, which was when Oregon's land use goals, interim goals, originally started. So if they're pre-1973, they're fairly straightforward because basically the landowner can do just about anything they want. After about 1994, the laws became much more clear as to what was allowed. In between 73 and 94, we had a gray zone where the goals were in flux as to what the standards were. And a lot of the goals actually on the ground were discretionary, or there were criteria that the counties had to apply directly. So anything in that zone of 73 to 94 becomes more complex to us. The second major thing that makes claims complex is just, quite frankly, the ownership questions. After going through a variety of these claims, we're spending a lot of time working with the Department of Justice trying to figure out who owns the property for ballot measure 37 purposes. And we're running into every aspect of trust law, corporate law, family ownership, illegal partitions of property through estate transfers, everything under the sun we're running into. Basically, we categorize the claims into three groups. Our lowest priority are our simplest claims. are in those two bookends. They're purchased before 73 or after 94, and the ownership is pretty clear. There's one owner primarily. If the claim has either of those ownership questions or fits into that gray zone period, they become a priority two claim for us or more complex. And then priority one claims, the highest priority, the hardest ones, have both ownership questions and planning questions. Those are the ones that go to our most senior planners. Basically, right now, probably about 36% of our claims are coming in, fall into that simplest category. 44% of them fall into that middle zone, and then another 20% are on the highest end or the most complex category. So that's how we're basically assigning work out to staff. As I said, we came to the January Emergency Board, and we got two planners and one administrative support position. Since that time, we've redeployed 17 other planners, which brings our total to about 60% of the planners within the department are working on ballot measure 37 claims to one extent or another. So 60% of our planners, and the only folks that are not working on ballot measure 37 at this point, are the people who have dedicated funding sources that we can't actually assign them work to. They're either federal funds or under the Coastal Zone Management Program, and any claims in the Coastal Zone go to that or costed to that program. The other ones are we have one planner that works exclusively with FEMA, Federal Emergency Management, and then the final group is our Transportation and Growth Management Group, which is funded through the Department of Transportation. So other than the people that we have discretion over are all working on ballot measure 37 claims. And that was simply just the number of claims that have come in that we were not expecting this volume to come through. As I look forward, or we look forward into 0507, which is the numbers that you have in front of us. Actually, let me add one other thing. What we're doing right now is we're tracking both the number of claims that come in and the hours it actually takes that people are spending working on these things. For the month of February, we had about 380 staff hours devoted to ballot measure 37 processing. And if you look on this sheet, you'll see a little box here that said basically what this box is that in order to hit our 180-day time frame under the measure, Department of Administrative Services gives us a target, which is about 40 days ahead of that, for when we need to get claims back to them. And so you'll see for the month of April, we had 14 claims are due back to Department of Administrative Services. And then you see with May, 47, June, 59, July, 78. And then the final one is August. Through the first 11 days of August, we have 39 claims. And actually adding two or three more days onto that is up to 50 already. So what I'm trying to point out to you is that what we're looking at is a growth curve right now. The number of claims coming in is still on the uptick. And what we've seen, and I'm not sure if we've talked about this with the committee before, but we are seeing waves of claims come in. The first wave was when ballot measure 37 passed, and we saw a number of claims that were filed, both dually with the state and with the local jurisdiction. Then local jurisdictions started pointing out to the claimants, for the claimants that only filed with the local jurisdiction, you now have to file with the state as well. That caused a second wave of claims to come into us. Third wave of claims started when we started sending out notice to the neighbors, and then a number of neighbors said, well, we could file a ballot measure 37 claim as well. And then fourth waves start when the land use bar starts advising clients of theirs that they can start. So what we're seeing is ticks of waves of new claims coming into us, and that's what we're dealing with right now.
Representative Schaffer.
It's a regular land use tsunami, ain't it? Hey, yeah. You know, and I got elected to city council in 96. You know, he said it was gray before 94. It didn't get any clearer for me. And it ain't yet either. But all these numbers you're talking about, and if you put this on a graph, you'd see a growing trend. Is this number here taking that growing trend into account, or is it going to run out of money?
Well, let me tell you what we're working off of with those assumptions, because we're working with the Department of Administrative Services. They're actually estimating the number of claims coming into us. And if I can jump over to 0507 right now, what they're projecting is that we'll get about 1,600 claims for 2005-07. Now, the way they came up with that number, which is about 67 claims a month, is simply taking the first 110 days and doing a simple average off of it. So it's not building in a growth pattern for us. And if we start getting in significantly more than 67 claims on an ongoing basis, we'd probably have to come back to an emergency board asking for that. The problem right now, Madam Chair, Representative Schaffer, is that I don't know what's going to happen down the road and if we peak out. What we've been advised by the Department of Administrative Services when they first started looking at this is that whenever you have a new cause of action created, it takes about a year and a half for that bubble to kind of flow through. So we're looking at least for the year and a half that we're going to be still on an uptick and finally coming back down. But it is too early right now to say. If we run into problems, we would certainly be back. So as far as coming up with the numbers, and I'll try and scoot through this pretty quick, because we do have a lot of folks here to talk. Basically what we did is that we ran through and we assumed that we'd continue to get 98% of those claims, so about 66% of them coming into us. We then based looking at the number of hours that we think it actually takes us to process those claims. And right now it's taking 20 to 40 hours per claim, but that's still very early in the process for us. So in the numbers you see here, I've actually projected that it will be somewhere between 13 and 24 hours per claim, again, depending on where that complexity level is that we've made some assumptions about. So we're expecting that we get more efficient over time as we move forward with these. Finally, what we do is that we've actually then break it out to the number of FTE based on where we think that needs to flow. And so the bottom line here is you'll see we're asking for 7 planner types. 5 planner threes and 2 program technician twos. The program technicians would actually be handling that simplest level of claim, and the planners would be handling the higher level. We've asked for an administrative support position, which we already currently have, even though it's a step higher than what was there before. And finally, a manager to take charge of this group. Right now, I've got a manager that's spending 80% of her time, and this takes up probably 60% of my time as a deputy just managing this system. So in effect, we're creating a new division within the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I went through and truth-tested this by actually tracking the number of hours that we are currently spending on ballot measure 37. As I started to say earlier, for the month of February, 380 hours, which is about 2.5 FTE, or the equivalent of 2.5 FTE. For the month of March, which again, we're still on the uptick, about 1,200 hours, which is the equivalent of about 6.5 FTE. And you'll see that on this chart, that's still an uptick stage. So bottom line, Madam Chair, is that I think that what we've given you today is probably a conservative estimate of what the department may need and assumes that we do hold to about 66, 67 claims per month, which you'll see for the month of July and August, we're already going to far exceed that. But again, I can't tell what's going to happen off into the future. So, Madam Chair, with that, if there's any questions, but that's what the package is.
I would appreciate it if you could talk to the committee about the process relationship between DLCD and DAS and DOJ. How is it wired together?
Madam Chair, the way the process works currently under the current administrative rule from the Department of Administrative Services is all claims have to be filed with the Department of Administrative Services to come into the state. Basically, DAS is doing 3 things right off the bat. The first is they make sure that there's a claimant listed, and quite frankly, there are some times when we can't, it's not clear to us who the claimant is. Second, they're sending out notices to all the neighbors. And third, they're making sure that we have the information about the property itself. They then transmit that information over to our agency, and we actually line out and say, here's what we think the rights of the claimant were at the time they acquired the property. So DAS is really an intake function, making sure some very, very basic information is there in the claim file, and getting the local information on neighbors. They then send it over to us, and we actually dispose of what the rights are of the claimant. Now, as part of that process, there may be questions that we need help on. So, for example, in a number of cases, because the ownership issues were too hairy, we've actually contacted the Department of Administrative Services and said, we need you to actually purchase us a title report. And we'll actually go out there to a title company, and DAS will contract with them, and we'll get a title report, and hopefully that clarifies it for us. The other thing that they might do for us, which we haven't run into yet, is they're setting up a contract to actually get appraisals if we need to get some officially.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. Can't the landowner present you with their title report that they got when they purchased the property?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffer, that would be the best case. And, in fact, what we do is we actually ask for that if we need it.
Well, actually, if I may, Madam Chair, Representative Schaffer, if the title report that they got when they purchased the property could be a 1950 title report. What's critical is not what was the status of the title in 1950, but what is it today? Because it's ownership today for the purpose of the claim and for the purpose of applying the land use regulations back at a particular point in time. So a historic title report that somebody might have acquired when they bought the property would show that, yeah, back in whatever year they did indeed purchase the property. It doesn't tell you who the owner is today or what other events have occurred in that chain of title. And I'll just a couple of examples. We've seen them. I'd like to say we've seen it all. I know we haven't. And that is transfers into and out of corporations, transfers, sales of property, followed by foreclosures, followed by bankruptcy, and all these things happening after a point in time that can only be identified with a current report that reflects it as of today. Many of these are not difficult. If we've got one from a claimant who bought the property in 1940 and can show us the deed by which she or he acquired title, and then a current property tax statement that shows the title in the same name, we're not requiring title reports for those. Those are perfectly acceptable. But you would be surprised how complex things get out in the world of property titles.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have nothing else unless there's questions for me.
Oh, I'm sorry. You asked, Madam Chair, about the relationship with DOJ, and I think George did a good job on DAS. The other thing with DOJ is just that right now, especially, and I hope we'll see less as time goes by, but right now, every one of these questions that comes into the measure claim is really a question of first impression. And our planners are very good at looking at a county's comprehensive plan and looking at what our administrative rules or statutes were at a particular point in time. They're not good at evaluating titles. They're not good at understanding corporate law and other business entities and how they relate to property ownership, bankruptcy, estate planning, which comes into this when property has been distributed through a trust or a will, and the law of trusts, too. Those are all things that come in, I would say, to a surprising extent in the claims that we've seen. There's just a lot of stuff out there.
Here, one quick.
So we ask for DOJ's advice on those kinds of questions.
Thank you. Let's say we do change the law, land use law. How quick are you all going to be able to react to that change in statute or land use law? Is that that's just crystal ball stuff, too?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I guess it is speculative because the question would be how much? And, you know, what effective date does the legislature place on that? My sense is that we are likely, almost no matter what happens, I think we're likely to see a bulge move through the snake for this next biennium anyway. It's going to be hard to stop that because even any change is likely to be prospective in effect, and I think you've got a lot of claims out there that are that have accrued.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you computed in this also the cost you might, you know, cost you might run into for getting advice from DAS, getting advice from Attorney General, getting the cost of getting titles up? That can be very expensive also. Is that computed in this policy package?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, what's in this package is the personnel cost for us and about $375,000 worth of Attorney General costs. The actual cost of title reports and appraisals would be over with Department of Administrative Services. We have not built anything in on that side for ourselves. But we do have built in there the cost that we would need for AG time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. George, probably to you. I assume you're kind of cannibalizing the rest of your departments, right? I mean, you're not getting anything else done other than things that are dedicated money you have to, you can't bring people over. Indicated to me almost all your planners are working on this now. And until this policy package goes through or doesn't go through, let's assume it does go through and you can deal with these over here. It seems to me you've got some people who are very knowledgeable about planning. They're now rapidly becoming knowledgeable about 37. Got to pull some people over to take care of that and then bring in new people that will potentially not be as knowledgeable about planning. I mean, you're thinking of a whole new thing here, temporarily possibly, because the bulge goes to the snake. How do you foresee your ability to function for the rest of the state, which depends on you for other decisions?
If I can take a stab at that, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, it is a concern. George mentioned, I think, that one of our managers is spending about 70-80% of her time managing the staff work. She happens to be our manager, who's also in charge of our economic development team. And for the last year, and spend a lot of time on the road, which is where she needs to be. And so that is a great concern. Our other manager is community services, who manages our field representatives, so he's in no better position to assign to this and sacrifice that. So that is a concern. In terms of, I also have Teddy Leland here as a great manager on the operation services, but she doesn't have any planners in her division, so they wouldn't be the folks to be doing this anyway. The issue about the staff that we would bring on for this, reallocating our current planning staff to the work that they have done and should be doing in order to further the ongoing core mission of the program. There are planners out there. In fact, we got a couple great ones just on the limited duration positions. Folks come in with planning experience at the local level, and so I'm confident we can fill that with the right people.
Last question, Madam Chair. Your planners, I assume, are not land use attorneys. This stuff can get really tricky. If you decide in favor of a case, you might be facing a challenge, I assume, from the county, or not. They might agree. Or if you deny a case, that might go to some form of an appeals court, local circuit court, I assume. Would you get called back in to testify in those situations, or are you sort of immune from doing it? Because that's another potential cost for you to go back in and have to, you've made a decision, and now the repercussion of the decision might come back to where you were required more time from your staff again.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the risk really does come down either way on a decision. If the decision is to deny a claim, then under the measure, the claimant has the option to go to circuit court to file an action for damages plus attorney fees and costs. So you face legal exposure if you deny a claim. If you grant a claim so that a use is then, by virtue of this decision, permitted on a property, Judge Wapner said anybody can sue anybody for anything, and I would not be surprised to see litigation brought on account of the granting, or at least an appeal by nature of a writ of review, perhaps, or something like that, of a decision to allow a claim by a dissatisfied neighboring property owner, perhaps, or somebody else that may be affected by it. So there is liability galore, opportunity for liability galore in the handling of these claims, either way you go.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, if I can tag in, just to clarify, there is nothing in this package related to litigation. All that we've got in front of you is just the process and the claims.
Well, to answer the question I was going to, that also is uncharted territory for you and could ensure more cost.
Significant more cost.
For the purposes of this presentation, we're assuming that we're going to be absolutely correct in every decision that we made and unassailable, so that we won't invite any frivolous challenges on either side.
Madam Chair, last comment here. It may be wise in the next 6 weeks before we sign and die, around here in 6 to 8 weeks, 12 weeks, 14 weeks, whatever it is, to revisit what information they have at that point. They might have a little more information about what's happening, what their costs are, and we might have to look at another package at that point. There's just too many ifs in this.
Madam Chair, we understand you're not going to work session today, and I think it would be premature to do it anyway.
And I don't want to be sitting on an e-board someday, 8 months from now, with, scarce funds, and us not being a 180-day thing, and you guys going to court, and all the kind of problems I can see developing from this.
We need to be doing a rebalance on this agency, the same that we do on
DHS. DHS might actually look like an easier rebalance than this one would be. So,
committee members, we have a process issue here that we need to move ahead with public testimony, because we have a lot of people that are here that aren't ordinarily in the building, and I want to give those people a chance to testify so they don't have to come back. This is an issue that we are going to need to revisit just because of the nature of it. And what I'd like to do is use the last half hour for public testimony. I'll try to pick all the people that I don't recognize as habituates of this building and bring them up first. And then we will also, if we need to, schedule further public testimony on Monday, April 18th, and conclude the public part of this hearing. So I would first call forward Arnold Kogan and John Anderson, and I think Stephen Cafoli will come with them.
Is the judge on? Who is this?
Arnold Kogan and John Anderson. Good afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafoli. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. I'd be happy to come back another day and present my testimony. As you know, I live in this building. These gentlemen have come from Portland, and if they could testify, I would appreciate it.
That would be just fine.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Arnold Kogan, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, and I'm chair of a committee called the Reengagement Committee. I'm also managing principal of a consulting firm in Portland, Kogan Owens Kogan. Handed out to you here is a copy of our recent Oregon chapter's Oregon Planning Journal. If you have a copy in front of you, what I'd like to do would be to have you turn to page 4, because what I'm talking about is coming out of that article on page 4 called It's Time to Reengage Oregonians in Land Use Planning. And that's an article that I co-authored with Dr. Noha Toulon, who's recently retired as Dean of the School of Urban and Public Affairs at Portland State University. My own background is that I have a connection with the department's program, because I was the first director of the department in 1973 when the Senate Bill 100 was passed. And for those first 2 years, that's when we met with thousands of Oregonians throughout the state in a program to write the goals. And that's when those goals were first written. And it was a major engagement program at that time. Nothing like it has been seen since. Recently, and this article refers to a committee called the COPE Committee. It's the Committee on Oregon Land Use Experience. It was formed 5 years ago, and Dr. Toulon was chair, and I was on that committee. We interviewed over 70 people around the state, made a great deal of study over a year's time to study what is happening with our state land use program. This was at a time when ballot measure 7 had already passed, and by the time we finished, it had already been declared unconstitutional. What we found was that as a result of our study in the year 2000-2001, that the land use program needs to be more flexible. It needs to be more regionally oriented throughout the state rather than having a state program top-down, more regional orientation. Needs to adopt a more fair and equitable approach to its business. And because ballot measure had been found unconstitutional, we were fearful that another measure, which shortly be coming along, to replace it, that wouldn't be unconstitutional. And out of that concern for ourselves, the planning community, and many others, a bill similar to Senate Bill 82 was put forward in the last session of the legislature. It didn't pass, as many of you probably know. And if it had passed, many of us are convinced that there would not be a need, would never have been a need for Measure 37, because we would have dealt with many of the fairness, many of the equity systems, many of the inflexibility problems and issues that many people are concerned about. So here we are now. We're back, and we're pressing, along with a number of other groups, to support Senate Bill 82. And funding for that is in a supplementary appropriation that's being proposed for the DLCD budget. And what I'm here today is to encourage and urge that you pass that supplementary budget. I'm joined with John Anderson over here.
As Madam Chair and committee members, I am John Anderson. I'm here as the chair of the Oregon chapter of the Fellows of the American Institute of Certified Planners. This is a group of professional planners that's organized at a national level. I have been a planner in Oregon for 35 years and practiced as a professional planner in a variety of communities throughout Oregon, and recently have retired as a professional planner. But to continue my commitment to the planning process, I have volunteered and am now a member of the City of Gresham's Planning Commission. I've had a commitment to citizen planning from the very beginning, and as part of that, I belong with two other members, a partnership that goes about the state of Oregon, training planning commissioners in the Oregon planning system, how to conduct public hearings, and how the Oregon system works. And it's been a great opportunity to see how planning is actually being carried out throughout the state of Oregon and to participate in a variety of different forums in discussing planning. I'd like to emphasize how important planning is to the many communities around the state of Oregon. There is tremendous support for planning throughout the state, and it has been demonstrated to be a particularly effective tool in helping communities organize themselves efficiently and to develop in ways that are beneficial for their overall community. I think, however, there is a growing recognition, just as Arnold mentioned, that there have been a lot of changes that have occurred since 1973. There is a need to take a look at the planning program and to look at how those changes result in need for changes to the system and how that system functions. Also, when I go about the state doing the Planning Commission training, it is really apparent that there is a growing consensus that there is a need to reduce the complexity, return to a greater emphasis on local control, to take a look at the differences that exist between the various regions of the state, and to reflect that in how the planning program conducts itself in this state. And I think that it's important that that occur in a program that really involves the citizens, that gets those 2,000-plus planning commissioners that exist out there and all of those other citizens that are real advocates for planning and for rational decision-making in the planning process and community development process. And to do that, you really have to have a program that is effectively funded and is carried out in a professional way. And that's one of the reasons why I felt it important to come down here today and talk about support for Senate Bill 82 and the funding package that's being proposed for addition to the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Any system that has been in place as long as the Oregon planning system has been, that has been subject to the great pressures that this program has found exerted on all sides of various issues, is going to find itself in need of major maintenance and updating. And it's certainly true of this program. This is just like any other vehicle that's had a long time on the road. It's great to take some minor maintenance kinds of things, and certainly the legislature has played an important role in making minor improvements as time has gone along. But at this point, we've now reached the time when it's important to look at a major overhaul, a chance to look at the program and to revitalize that program and reconnect it to the people of the state. And I believe this is an opportunity with Senate Bill 82 and the funding for that program to make that a reality. And with that, I'll turn it over to Stephen.
And I would ask you, please, in the interest of time, to confine your comments to Senate Bill 5518, when the other bill, if it is assigned to us, we'll be having hearings on that bill at that time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to just make one final comment, and that is that a number of local governments around the state are putting filing fees for Ballot Measure 37. The only reason the state doesn't have one is not because it was a conscious decision not to make a filing fee for 37, but because there was no previous authorization for any of the state departments, whether it was ODF&W or LCDC or DAS or anyone else, to do such a filing fee. And you've heard about the costs. I think a lot of these costs were not anticipated. And it seems to me that the legislature at least ought to examine that issue and not let it go by default. The issue is that if people apply for a permit for anything else, they have to pay for the cost of the processing of that fee. We certainly don't want to have something that would be inhibitory of people exerting their legal rights. But I think the legislature should examine the possibility of having some a token fee that would cover some of the costs. If we're going to be talking about millions of dollars of general fund money for this, and some people are getting the benefit of this and other people are not, then this is exactly the kind of situation where a fee ought to be examined. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your testimony today. The next panel that I will call will be Pat Zimmerman, Steve Clark, and Mike Robinson. Zimmerman, if you'd like to begin.
Certainly. My name is Pat Zimmerman. I'm from Scappoose area. I'm the chair of the Citizens Involvement Advisory Committee, which is an LCDC-appointed committee charged with implementing and monitoring and encouraging Goal 1, which is the citizen involvement goal of our land use system. This is a volunteer committee. There's 8 of us on it. Geographically, we cover the entire state. And we have been very concerned after some of us have been on it for a couple of years now, about the lack of citizen involvement in almost every aspect of the land use program. We all got there somehow by participating at the local level, and we have seen an awful lot of discomfort and difficulty at that level throughout the land use system. I realize SB 82 isn't what we're here for, but I would like to put a plug in. It's critical that we reconnect with the citizens. Further, I would like to point to one thing that our committee would like to do, and DLCD, I believe, would like to do it also with us. We have hundreds and hundreds of contacts with local citizens all over the state, and we have no way of automating or annotating or otherwise keeping track of these people and using them to improve our land use system, because the IT budget for DLCD is simply cannot support even moderately good technology. My background's high tech. I have a doctorate in information science, and I've seen a lot, but I was absolutely appalled when I took a look at DLCD's computer systems. They don't have the money they need to do even the basics, and we would certainly like to have their help and some support in getting citizen involvement working. And one of the only ways you can do that is to know where the people are, who they are, what they're interested in, have fairly sophisticated databases. So I would ask that you strongly support the IT budget and help them get up to somewhere close to up to date. That's it.
Thank you. Is it Clark or Clark?
Yes, Clark.
Clark, please
I'm
proceed.
I'm sure I misunderstood. I thought you'd be taking testimony on Senate Bill 82 and the funding for it today. I will be out of state trying to help Oregon's economy on the 18th, so I'm not able to be there at that time if you were to.
Well, in the I think in the interest of fairness, this is the ways and means process. This is not the policy part of the building. So we don't get the bills here until they get referred to us by the policy part of the process. And then the bill needs to be assigned to committee by both of the co-chairs. And so I think that in order for all of those stars to line up, it's going to require quite a bit more, what can I say, good luck than I see in the future right now. So in the interest of time, if you have written testimony, we would be glad to take it. But I think that in the eventuality that the bill does get a hearing in this process, that it would be better to deal with that when it came up.
Let me provide the staff that and then return if you hold a later date.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And Mr. Robinson.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Michael Robinson. I'm a land use attorney with the firm Perkins Coie in Portland.
Sorry.
I've been privileged to represent the city of Hermiston as their special land use counsel for the last, 12 years now. I've practiced land use law in Oregon since 1991. I'm a member of the American Planning Association and the American Institute of Certified Planners. And I wanted to just mention quickly to you, I've given you a letter that you can take a look at, but I wanted to mention quickly to you the two matters I worked with Mr. Shetterly and the field reps with on behalf of the city of Hermiston. Lane talked a little bit about those. One was a 400-acre boundary expansion to allow development of a golf course and a surrounding planned unit development, and the city thought this was really important to its economic development. And we were able to work with the field reps to understand what they needed to find compliance with the law, and quite successfully we were able to have the city adopt the boundary expansion. We didn't have any appeals, and the department supported it, or at least didn't appeal it. And we were very pleased with the way they worked with us. I concur with what Lane said. They came to City Hall. They talked with me. They talked with the planner. They talked to the City Council. They came to the hearing. When we needed to talk to them on the phone, we were able to organize conference calls and resolve issues. And I have to tell you, that's a big change from the past. And I think a lot of that is due to Lane. The other thing that we worked on behalf of the City of Hermiston was associated with the Umatilla County's Peer Act Review Work Task, and Lane alluded to that as well. It was a large exception to Goals 3 and 14 for the industrial area north of Interstate 84. As you're driving west towards or east towards Pendleton, and you get what looks to be the City of Hermiston. If you're not familiar with the area, it's all of the industry that's out there. The city's interest in that was prompted by the fact that a large food processing plant, about 500,000 square feet in size, closed. And under the existing rules, there would have been very limited reuse potential for that plant. So working with the field reps, with the department, and with the county, we were able to have an exception adopted in the periodic review work task, and I think that makes that area much more available for industrial growth in the future. Both of those projects were very important to the City of Hermiston, and we very much appreciated the collaboration and the attitude from the department. So I'm here to support their budget. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad to hear things are working more cooperatively.
It's a good sign.
It is. Okay. I appreciate. Even though he's a Republican, I appreciate Lane sometimes. I got a tooth just pulled out. No anesthetic.
No, I just got to say this too, Madam Chair. It seems like Lane. It's like some little whippersnapper who's insulting a young woman for years until he finds out it's the mill owner's daughter. What we've done is we've been insulting landowners for years, and now we're trying to backpedal on it.
He deserves it. I'm not backing off. You have more testimony?
Yeah, I'm just getting it straightened out here. Oh, wonderful. We are very privileged to have another elected official here, the mayor of the city of Gold Beach, Carl Popoff. We would invite you to come forward and give us testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee. My name is Carl Popoff. I am the mayor of Gold Beach. I was asked to come to this, first and foremost, by Mr. Bob Bailey, who happens to be a very old friend of mine. We grew up together, quite frankly. And also by Mr. Shetterly. I think most of you know that on the coast, since we had our timber taken away from us, we have struggled a great deal. And we've been in a recession for far longer than what the rest of the state has. It has not been that long ago that we have seen some signs of recovery. Now, we still don't have anything to fill the void the timber left, but nevertheless, we are starting to move financially, economically now. And a lot of that has to do with investments being brought into the area and building taking place. We had a problem, and Representative Krieger, he knows all about this. In fact, he's already alluded to it, the problem that we had last summer. And you know, this was quite a large undertaking, and the fellow that had started this venture went through every one of the hoops, and yet nevertheless it looked as if we were going to run afoul of some regulations or restrictions. So we contacted, Bob Bailey contacted me. He generally, if there's, looks as if there might be a problem, and he sees one coming, he'll go ahead and give me a heads up to let me know that we might indeed need some help. We looked at it, and lo and behold, this is the first time, mind you, that this has ever happened. In Gold Beach, Oregon, we had the director of a major state organization come personally to us. Now, that impressed me. But not as much as the fact that no sooner had he been there, and we sat around that table, I think, for about an hour, hour and a half, somewhere in that neighborhood, hashing things out. We had our problem taken care of. The man, the developer, was able to continue. There were some compromises made. Nevertheless, he was able to continue. Now, this is given, and I'll be very blunt with this, given our past association with LCDC, this is very refreshing. Very, very refreshing. I mean, to actually see a government agency want to help you, I mean, it's interesting.
Yeah. I'm trying to point out he is also the mayor. He's a government agency.
Yes. But held much more accountable on a very, very more immediate basis. But seriously, though, no, I do appreciate that. It's very refreshing. And I know that Lane has personally made that responsible and come to fruition. So I just want to say that, I'm thankful for what he's doing in this. And it has become an agency that is much more friendly to us out there in the hinterlands. And that's pretty much all I have to say, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Yeah,
Representative Shaw?
Yes, sir.
Would you say thank you for coming all this way? I had the opportunity to go to Gold Beach last summer, and I can't wait to go back. And go
pleasure to have you back.
My wife and daughter. I spent some money there, too. Would you say there was, if you had to, judge what the difference between when Mr. Shatterly and before, would you say he brought some flexibility? Would you use that word in applying land use law in Gold Beach relative to who was there before, or was it a different interpretation? I mean, I know he's an awfully friendly guy, and we all love him here, but what exactly, other than he being aggressive? Boy, they're just beating the crap out of you today, Lane. I'm trying to help you out here, buddy. Anyway, that word flexibility is really what I'm looking for, because, in my opinion, we have painted ourselves into the corner, in a lot of ways due to our rigid stand on things. This is perfect. We can change it a little bit, but it's... It was foggy before 94, and now it's all clear. Now, I'm sorry, I don't mean to beat up anybody. Would you say that word could be used, flexibility or not?
Yes, sir, I could very easily. In fact, it's not so much, as far as I understand it, that the rules and regulations as such have changed. But sometimes in the past, what we felt came across was the iron fist of the law and not the intent, but rather the fact that, well, this is the way it is, this is the way you have to do it. We don't care if you go broke, belly up, or anything else that you have to do, you know. But this has changed. And like I said, it was very refreshing. There is that flexibility there. And I am just thankful to Mr. Shatterly for personally making that visit. And quite frankly, that is the reason I'm here today. He made the visit to us. So I'll make the 500-mile round trip for him. That's how strongly I feel about it.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
I think it's interesting that 3% of the people in Oregon know where Curry County is.
Mm-hmm.
If you say Gold Beach, it goes to 7%. And I wondered if the director had to go on MapQuest to find his way.
Most beautiful place in Oregon.
It is.
Well, and I would submit, too, that once you get pointed in the right direction, you kind of end up there.
Yeah. Kind of like a funnel.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate
you
giving us your time.
Thank you very much.
The I will call forward now Bob Stacey and John Chandler.
Should be fun.
People we've never seen in the building.
As you say, people will pay to see them at the table together.
Yeah, to so have
experience here. Can I be excused for the rest of this meeting?
This is an interesting panel we have here.
Yeah.
Mr. Stacey, please proceed.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, first of all, just in the interest of time, you've already admonished one witness for proposing to testify on, I think it's called Policy App Option Packet 103. Bob Stacey, 1000 Friends of Oregon Executive Director, I apologize. But my intention today was simply to speak on behalf of the proposed appropriation in the governor's budget in Policy Option Packet 103, which would fund activities related to the implementation of the proposed major review of land use planning contained in Senate Bill 82. The chair has admonished us to focus on departmental matters and this budget and to defer testimony about Senate Bill 82 until that bill is heard by this committee.
Well, and I have been reminded by my able administrator here that because the Senate bill hasn't been posted, we aren't permitted to take testimony on it.
And then I shall only address briefly Policy Option Packet 103. There's a dollar amount there to support a far-reaching review over two biennia, the initial portion of two biennia, to review the effectiveness of our existing land use planning program and assess whether comprehensive changes should be made to that land use planning program on the basis of research, information, and public opinion gathered through an aggressive program. 1000 Friends of Oregon supports that undertaking, believes that, as some of the planner testimony you heard earlier put it, it is well overdue, and we would welcome the opportunity to testify in more detail when you hear Senate Bill 82.
Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I handed in testimony from Mr. Steve Clark with Community Newspapers, and I believe here in his capacity as the chair of the Westside Economic Alliance, if I get his provenance correctly. He was unable to stay for the rest, but his testimony deals with Senate Bill 82, which is not in front of you. When the time comes for that bill here, I suspect you'll see many of the usual of the same folks come back and talk about it. And I want to talk on the, in terms of the department's budget. You've heard a lot of good commentary about Director Shetterly, and I'd like to join in that. Lest, you know, I don't want to go overboard because we'll need a hand truck to get his head out the door.
But he's blushing.
I hope so. Yes.
It's been a worry of mine, too.
As you know, I've been playing in the sandbox for many years. We've always been in support of the department's budget from the development community, usually betting the come, if you will, that if the department had a good budget, if they had the staff, if they had a funding source, maybe someday they would do something that we'd like. I got suckered into that for about 15 years, and I'm very pleased to report, and I think this is largely Director Federley's doing, the mindset at that agency has changed dramatically. The rules haven't particularly. I'll get to that in a minute. But the mindset, the attitude, the how do we do it, not no we can't, the how do we get there, not you can't get there from here, the willingness to engage outside the usual suspects. Getting to Gold Beach is something that hasn't happened very often. Getting to the development community hasn't happened very often. Getting to people outside of the people who hang out in this building hasn't happened very often. And I think there's a credit to Director Federley's work and the work he's done with his staff. I didn't think it was doable. I thought it was the agency was a do-over, frankly. I'm very impressed, and I would commend the budget to you on no other basis than that. I think the support that this legislature, frankly, owes Director Federley for the work he's done in making a fairly monumental change, with limited resources and with a set of statutes and rules that have handcuffed a lot of the work that we'd like to do. And as a brief segue into that big picture review, the system is still broken. We can put more money in this department. We could double this budget. We could triple the budget. We could pick a number of this budget, and the system within which it operates is still, I believe, broken and needs repair work. That will be in front of you. It'll be in front of you on other substantive bills. It'll be in front of you in this committee. I urge you to look seriously at the changes we can make, not only through the Measure 37 rewrite that will hopefully get to this side of the building before session's out, but in terms of the other piece of legislation, and more particularly in terms of certain bill that will be in this committee, hopefully sooner rather than later. I think we have a good job started. It's not a good job finished yet. I think the people of this state and this agency deserve the legislature support now to make that happen. One final personal note, before I came in here today, I got a very sad phone call from my daughter, eldest daughter, who's a first-year law student in Santa Clara, and she left me a message that she has just started zoning law in her property class, property law class, and she said, "Dad, there's no way I'm going to come work with you." So I was pretty devastated.
And Chair, I might tell you, that's not the reason she won't come.
There's that. That's a whole different hearing.
I do, in the 5 remaining minutes, have a question that I'd like to pose both of you. In this fiscally challenged time that we're in, we have a great need to do as much restoration as we can in the education, human services, and public safety areas of the budget. And the natural resource segment has always kind of been low on the radar screen in compared to those big three budgets. I would just be very interested in your personal perspectives on whether you would prioritize the Measure 37 issues or the land use review issues above each other. Just a little bit of your perspective on
that. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, the choice again, the balance?
The initiative issues, the Measure 37 issues that the agency is facing, the processing issues and those kinds of things, or the review of the statutes?
My goodness, look at the time.
I got a pie in the oven.
Madam Chair, if as an either or, that's a difficult question. And let me reframe it, if I might.
Take a try at it.
That seat's getting hot again.
So,
think
the thoughts will repeat this year. I frankly think that looking at the underlying system would be where I put my money. You correctly observed that the natural resource and all agencies have taken short shrift in the light of the budget crisis and are not able to turn out busloads of folk in support of their budgetary wants. And that's not a criticism of this legislature. The choices have been made by previous legislatures. I think some of those choices, frankly, could have been made differently. And I'm not on that side of the dais. I think that the connection between the economy of this state and the tax revenue generated from that economy, which then go to fund these schools, the health care, the public safety, that connection oftentimes gets frayed, and where the fraying tends to occur is in land use, is in wetlands, is in environmental, is in the natural resource agencies that haven't got the funding to do the work they need to do better, different, other. And you know, that's a hard case to make when you're faced with a budget need today. That's long term. But I think because we haven't done that, we have these various ballot initiatives, we have the squabbles over environmental issues that don't help move the economy forward other than the legal profession, and that's while I are one, not necessarily where you need to spend your economic development dollars. So that I think I would put the money, frankly, I would encourage you to put it into the rewrite of the problems that got us into Measure 37 in the first place.
Thank you. Mr. Stacey, could I have the benefit of your perspective?
I will acknowledge, just as John has, that's a very tough question. It's a hard choice. I would put the third piece of the budget on the table, and that's the existing program of the department. Not because I disagree with John's assessment of the job that the director and the department are doing, but because that is part of the choice before you. I wouldn't recommend that you cut any of them, but I would prioritize the big look, the colloquialism that Mr. Chandler coined last session for the major review of land use planning, above business as usual in the administration of the department's functions. That hurts me to say. I don't think there's some fat in the Department of Land Conservation and Development or in the Natural Resource Agencies generally, to the extent I'm familiar with them. But the priority before the state should be to review and assess the performance of this program independently of the department itself, and independently of John and me. This ought to be a blue ribbon undertaking by people who don't have all their dogs in the fight we call the land use planning program. People who put Oregon first and the minutia of various positions on land use planning well down the list, and who try to look at the planning program such as it exists today from the perspective of a long-term commitment to the state and to the state's future. That's important work. It's work that some would argue has been deferred too long. If you had to rate current business versus reviewing how we've done and where we ought to be going, I would put the latter ahead of current business.
Members, this brings us to the end of the time that we have allotted today. We still have people on the public testimony list that haven't had a chance to testify, so we will be opening another hearing on, when did we decide to do this? Monday the 18th. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5518. And Ms. McGlashan has an announcement for us.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, when you received your schedule for this week, at the end of last week, it was noted that the opportunity for public testimony on DSL's budget bill, which will be up tomorrow and Thursday, would be the following Monday. That's no longer the case. The opportunity for public testimony will be on Thursday of this week on DSL's budget bill. So if you have any constituents who are wanting to testify, Thursday would be the day for that, not next Monday as originally planned. Tomorrow you're starting the phase two public hearings on the Department of State lands.
Monday, Tuesday at this point?
Pardon me?
Nothing Monday, Tuesday?
Monday we'll continue the public hearing for this. And I don't know what schedule you will be.
If somebody wants to testify on Department of State Lands budget bill, Thursday of this week will now be the day. It was originally for next Monday, but we had to switch the schedule.
Apparently, the committee is going out to our cities, and I don't think I have one this Thursday.
I just wanted to let you know that in case you needed to.
And with that, I will adjourn the hearing.